love to you, baby.
What was the soundtrack of your youth? I was in fourth and fifth grade when bluesy British rock and roll suddenly blew up and got my attention. When the Rolling Stones and the Beatles appeared on TV.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Beatles!
And my local top 40 radio station started playing Bob Dylan.
Johnny's in the basement, mixing up the medicine. I'm on the pavement, thinking about the government. Man in the trench coat, badge out, laid off. Says he's got a back off, wants to get paid off. Look out, kid.
Although that's not Dylan singing Subterranean Homesick Blues. It's the fictional mid-60s band that David Chase invented for his new movie, Not Fade Away. So, having created a masterpiece, The Sopranos, David Chase has now finally gotten to make his first feature film 40 years after graduating film school. Not Fade Away is set in New Jersey and co-stars James Gandolfini, but has got nothing to do with organized crime, and there's almost no violence to speak of. David Chase, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you.
So you were 18, I calculate, when the Beatles and Rolling Stones appeared in America. Was the germ of this film, I want to dramatize that moment of the culture, or I want to dramatize my youth?
It was, I want to dramatize how big of an impact started on that day with that invasion.
That's for you when the 60s began, essentially.
Yeah, absolutely.
So there's a scene in the film where all these kids are watching the Rolling Stones on Dean Martin's Hollywood Palace. Was that literally the moment in your life when you went, holy cow, or was there such an aha moment with the Stones?
I think I missed that broadcast on Hollywood Palace. As I recall, I don't think I saw that. But I did see the Beatles on Ed Sullivan.
As did we all.
And I know the first time I did see the Stones on, I guess by that time, was Ed Sullivan. It blew me away, yeah. And, I mean, it really set my course.
And you were, from the beginning, a Stones guy rather than a Beatles guy?
No. I really like them both.
Yeah, me too.
I really like them both.
When people say that, I say no.
I don't understand that. There's people like, they like that myth. There was this dichotomy. I got into the blues because of the Stones. And I learned a lot about American history, strangely enough, and the history of, you know.
Yes, African-American music.
Yeah, African-American music, which I was not really learning before that. But another thing is, for a musician, the Beatles are harder. Those Beatle harmonies, if you're trying to do a band. To sing those harmonies is tough.
It's easier to be a garage band covering the Stones.
I think so.
This main character, Douglas, wants to be a rock and roll guy, as I guess at his age, roughly, you did as well.
I did, me and bazillions of others.
And that's why you're a famous rock and roll musician today.
That's, you know, you have a dream and stick to it.
And he's got a tough father who doesn't approve of that ambition or pretty much anything else that's going on in the culture at that moment. James Gandolfini plays the dad.
Your mother and Evie, go to Lauderdale. Visit Aunt Lee. I'll buy dinner. We need to discuss what happens you become man of the family.
Okay.
Don't make a federal drama out of it. All fathers and sons should have this conversation. You're almost 21! A haircut is too much to ask, I'm sure, but you show up at that restaurant without a tie and a jacket, you and me gonna tangle, my friend.
That's John Magaro and James Gandolfini in Not Fade Away. You've said elsewhere that you and Mr. Gandolfini had something of a falling out coming off the Sopranos. How come?
What happened? We didn't really have a falling out. It just sort of fell apart or moved apart. It was a long time. It was a very hard show to do, and it was very tough on him. And he, with good reason, got tired of it. And he'd seen enough of me, and I probably had seen enough of him.
And then when you were writing this movie, did you think, aha, he should play the father?
I did say exactly that. Aha, he should play the father. But I didn't, not right away. I wrote a draft and I didn't think about him at all. The idea came up that let's try Jim at it. And I pictured him, the scenes were all written and I pictured him doing the scenes. And it completely put the movie in kind of bold relief for me. The tone of the whole piece, not just the scenes that he was in.
John Magaro is slight and not conventionally handsome, leading man-ish, which made me think of this a quote you gave about what happened in the early mid-60s, which is that for regular kids, it went from being the frat boys who were the really sexy guys to the androgynous guys. Was that your sense of it at the time or just in retrospect?
No, but I was talking to a friend of mine. This is back in the 80s, who said to me, he had been a drummer in a band too. And he said that was the great thing about it at that time was that if you weren't a jock, it was a way for you to get girls and also prove to your father he didn't know what the he was talking about.
And did your time being a drummer and doing music last about as long as the kids in the movies?
Yeah, but we didn't play as much as the kids in the movies. We didn't play. We never played a gig for anybody. We just played in the basement for ourselves and were plotting out all of our big moves.
And the hero talks later in the film about he thinks he may want to make movies, and he goes out to Los Angeles. So one can't help but imagine, wow, this is pretty autobiographical.
That part of it is autobiographical. In fact, I had a conversation with one of the guitar players. We were in a car in the village, and he said, I was going to get married. He said, what are you going to do? I said, I think we'll go out to California and go to film school. And he said, well, go ahead, but frankly, I don't think you'll be anything but the drummer in my band ever, which was the most motivating thing anyone ever said to me. I owe him everything.
And you wrote screenplays.
I wrote screenplays. None of them got produced. I was very frustrated. And when The Sopranos came along, it wasn't my first TV show either, but I never really – the ones that I had created hadn't stayed on the air very long, which I didn't want them to stay on the air very long.
But you had this Emmy-winning, successful career writing for Rockford File and Northern Exposure and all these things.
Well, the siren song of the movies was still there. That's what I had set out to do, and that's what I wanted to do, and I wasn't doing it. And so by the time I got to The Sopranos, I was very frustrated. And I just thought, just let it out. Just let it all go and see what happens.
Because at that point, you were over 50 and decided I don't need to, like, struggle just to get the next TV show that I don't care about made?
I thought, well, you're going to go on to do other TV shows anyway. Someone will hire you, and you'll go on to be a showrunner for this cop or that lawyer.
But 52 is the Writers Guild early retirement age. You could have gotten out.
I didn't know that.
I'm telling you. If only you'd known then, we wouldn't have The Sopranos.
Right.
Given that you're The Sopranos guy, and that will be in the headline of your obituary.
When is that going to happen?
I do know, but I can't tell you.
Okay.
I assume people around you said, oh, you should extend that brand and make some violent, dark movie as your first feature.
Some people did. Stevie Van Zandt said you should do that. My friend Terry Winter, who I worked with on The Sopranos, said the same
thing.
Empire. Yeah, they didn't say you should do more Sopranos. But we were watching No Country for Old Men, and Terry said you could do a really good movie kind of like in this vein.
And so how come you didn't?
I didn't have an idea that was really sufficiently worked out to my satisfaction at the time.
So if The Stones, I guess, set you on your path as a musician briefly, was there a TV show that you watched that you thought, wow, that's something I could do too?
No, I was too young to think about. I never thought about doing TV, about working in TV. I only went to film school because I wanted to work in movies.
Really? You didn't watch The Twilight Zone and said, oh, I can do
that? Oh, I watched The Twilight Zone, but, you know, I was 11 or 12. I never thought, oh, I could do that. But I certainly watched it. I watched it religiously. I think a show that was very influential to me in TV was I Spy was one of them.
And 1963.
Yeah. And then obviously, Twin Peaks is a great – the first season was a great landmark.
When something like Twin Peaks happened, did you start to think, I may be cynical about this career I've stumbled into, but that shows that great television can get done and maybe they'll let me do it?
All I remember thinking was, you know, being a bus driver, you know, all I kept thinking was, wow, how'd they drive that bus? How'd they get that bus on there?
Yeah.
That's really a cool bus there.
Yeah.
That's all I could think about. Wow, how'd they do that? I didn't think like, well, they've done it once and they'll do it again.
Since you always wanted to be a director and now you are a film director, how come you directed so few episodes of The Sopranos?
Just the running of the show took up so much of my time and the editing became very important. So I just didn't have the time for it. Between working in the writer's room, developing story, and then editing the film afterward, I loved the editing process so much. I spent more and more time in there.
And when it became the commonplace thing that this has launched a golden age of television, which is as true as any statement like that can be, how did that feel?
Well, I didn't see that. Because when I looked at network television, it looked just the same to me. I didn't see anything.
Yeah, but The Wire, Deadwood, Breaking Bad. That's what I mean.
I don't know. I don't know. I never connected with me that it, now with more historical perspective, I can see where people would say that. But at that time, I didn't see it that way.
Yeah. No. Now, great shows about middle-aged guys involved in crime are essentially the golden age of television.
Yeah, they are. But I didn't see it that way then.
Okay. Now you do see it that way. Are you proud?
I guess you'd have to call it pride. I mean, I'm glad.
Yeah. That there's better shows on.
I'm glad there's better shows on. And if I had any influence on anybody about it, great. You know, I'm glad that I did that too.
Yeah. So we announced to our listeners that you were coming on and they sent us some questions. May I ask you
sure.
two of them? This is from a listener named Lisa Giordano.
No, not her. I will not answer any questions for Lisa Giordano.
Okay. She says... You may take that seriously once you hear the question. I've always been interested, says Lisa Giordano, to know the thinking behind the surname change from De Cesare to Chase. And why Chase exactly?
Okay. My father came from a family of, I think, 12 children. His mother was a woman named Teresa. She came over to this country when she was, I think, 11 years old and worked in a mill. She met a guy who was much older than her. And married him. She was married by the time she was 15. She had 4 children with him. It was a loveless marriage, apparently. And a boarder came to live in the house who was, by the time she was 21, the boarder was 17. They began to have an affair. She had 2 or 3 kids by the boarder who she told the husband were his. But the whole thing fell apart. And his name was De Cesare. And that was the family name. The boarder's name was Fusco. Fusco. And at some point, the boarder, Joe Fusco, and my grandmother left Providence, Rhode Island with all the kids. And they went to the Italian neighborhood in Newark, and they took a name like Chase just because it would be impossible to track them.
Huh. So you didn't change it in order to be successful in show business. It was changed for you.
You mean the Tony Curtis name change?
Yeah,
no.
Yeah, or
no.
Woody Allen or whatever.
No, I was born David Chase. My father, I think, had to go through a lot of stuff legally to get it changed because they were known by the name. They went to school under the name Chase, and it was a problem
How
getting
interesting.
Back.
That's a good story to use somewhere.
Well, I know the implication of that question. I know what she's saying.
She has an Italian name.
Yeah, I know what she's aiming at.
Another question from Nimesh Ramasvaram. From his past comments, Chase has always had a love-hate relationship with television. Would he ever create another show?
I would say it's like 95%. The answer is no. Not because I wouldn't enjoy it, because I've gotten to like television over time. I want to straighten this out. The love-hate relationship I have with television, the hate relationship I have with television has to do with network television. At the same time, that's where I worked for so
right.
long.
Right.
At the same time, I worked with some of the best people. I mean, the most talented. I learned a lot. I worked with great people. So I don't have a hate relationship. But with cable, it's a whole different thing. Would I do another show? No, only because I've done it. And I've done it for, I don't know, 40 years or so. And that's enough.
Yeah.
35, whatever it was.
Also, why push your luck when you've created a really good one?
Yeah, I don't think I could do it as well, and I don't think I'd have the energy for it. I think I put everything into that show.
Yeah.
I put everything into The Sopranos. I don't know where I'd get more.
You're going to make more films, though?
I'd like to, yeah.
David Chase, thank you very much.
It's really been a pleasure. Thank you.
David Chase is the writer and director of Not Fade Away. It opens next week.
I'm going to tell you how it's going to be. Are you going to give your love to me? You know my love will not fade away.
So what's the one song that woke you up to the world as an adolescent? And if you are an adolescent, what's that song right now? Tell us at studio360.org.